Welcome to District Insiders. We are the newest addition to the world of podcasting. We're not the new kids on the block. As a matter of fact, we're the older guys on the block. We know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two, but we think we'll be providing all kinds of interesting guests and all kinds of interesting stories. So stay tuned.
Andrew Craig, your co-host of our show, District Insiders with Wayne Manson, who you just heard from. And we are totally thrilled to present as our guest, Abraham Bolden Sr., a living legend, a hero for our times, coming to us from Chicago. And he holds a number of distinctions. First, I guess I'd say a witness to the events, many of the important events and background of the JFK presidency 60 years ago, when he was the first African-American to be asked to join a presidential security detail for the U.S. Secret Service. He also has taken a very heroic whistleblowing mode describing certain events leading up to the assassination, along with his perceptions, for which he was cruelly prosecuted, framed, and imprisoned. And just a year ago, President Biden officially pardoned him in the first pardons of the Biden presidency because of years, if not decades, of advocates saying that he had been framed, that he was a hero. And President Biden recognized that by naming him as one of the first three people pardoned about a year ago during the presidency. So without further ado, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your important insights, both from that period, but also continuing through your observations.
Welcome. Thank you for inviting me, sir. I appreciate the invitation.
Let me add by way of another brief bit of background before we get into some of our questions and his recollections that I've had the privilege of helping a number of JFK researchers through the years at their scholarly and other conferences, including Citizens Against Political Assassination and elsewhere, where they've honored our guest and given him awards for how he's stepped forward. And with that background, I'm gonna have a few show and tells. One is this very powerful memoir that our guest wrote, The Echo from Dealey Plaza. And let me ask you about starting at the beginning in your book, how was it and what were you doing that led you to be hired by the Secret Service?
Well, I was a college graduate. I graduated from Lincoln University in 1956 with a degree in the fine arts. But I had always wanted to become in law enforcement to make some kind of contribution to my people and to humanity. I'd also wanted to become a minister because I felt that somewhere along the line that I would be of service to the higher troops. So after I graduated from Lincoln University, I had a job offer in Mayfield, Kentucky as a music teacher. I turned that down because I became employed as the first African-American for the Pinkerton National Detective Agency I was a full-fledged detective. I was told by the person that hired me that I was the first African-American or Negro that was a full-fledged detective for that agency. And that happened in St. Louis, Missouri in 1956.
Can I interrupt for just a quick moment to say that for those who don't know the background, Pinkerton was the security force for President Lincoln and afterwards. And so we're seeing a little bit of a straight line here from Lincoln University to Pinkerton. And I'll just add that we hope to have the Illinois State Society, which I'm a board member of, which honors President Lincoln, of course, show this video to our members. So with that interruption, but it's got a purpose of helping your story be relevant to these kind of wider audiences, but please go ahead.
Yes, it does. Well, I spent about a year with Pinkerton, and they trained me very well in the camera technology and investigative procedures. After that, in 1957, I went into the Illinois State Police, and I became a state trooper. That's where I met and saw, for the first time at a distance, President Kennedy. He was a senator running for the U.S. presidency at the time. He came through Peoria in 1960 to give a speech in front of the courthouse, a campaign speech. You know, he was running against Nixon. All right. Now, during his visit there, there was a Secret Service agent, special agent in charge, Fred Baxter. I was the one appointed to escort Fred Baxter around the city while he was on that detail. During our conversation, I asked Fred Baxter whether or not they had any Negro Secret Service agents. Fred Baxter said he didn't think so, but I could put in an application and he would process. So I went to Springfield, Illinois, filed an application, and on October 30th of 1960, I was transferred to Chicago and became a member of the United States Secret Service. And that's how I happened to become a member.
And what were your duties like as you began? And what were some of your experiences like in those early months and first couple of years of your time?
Of the Secret Service?
Yes.
Oh, they were very horrific, I would say, because I was from a small town, familiar with segregated facilities. But Chicago was a little different. Even though there was a division between the races, and in the 1960s, you know, that was one of the worst times for race riots that was all over the world at that time. We had many, many lynchings during that period, that period of time. Just before the 60s, we had the lynching of Emmett Till, and that sparked many riots that were subsequent to that particular event. So now when I came to Chicago, I wasn't very well received. In the first place, no one helped me find a place to lodge. I ended up living with my sister for several months, who was a nurse here in Michael Reese Hospital. And the assignments were in basically that I had were check cases that were in African-American neighborhoods. Now, you know, whenever the president traveled, Kennedy won the election in Chicago by some 8,000 votes. And that's really what put him in the presidency. So on April 28th, President Kennedy was scheduled to come to Chicago to thank Mayor Daley. Had a big convention at McCormick Hall, McCormick Place, they call it today. Now, whenever the president would travel, there's a contingent of agents who are stationed in whatever city he travels in, who has assistant aid in the president's protection. When they were assigning the protective position, normally they used uniformed policemen in places where there might be some confusion as to whether or not entrance or exit could be at that position. So now they've moved uniformed policeman from in front of a washroom. And they gave me his place. He assigned me to stand in front of a washroom. I was somewhat disappointed, but at that time, I'd only been on the Secret Service for a few months. But I did understand that this was strictly a racial thing that was going on, because some of the comments made on the meetings prior to the assignment were negative. And they were saying, well, that's what you deserve and that's where your people need to be. Such comments that would destroy the integrity of the position that I was holding. So now here I am assigned to the washroom on April the 28th, 1961. On the lower level of McCormick Place, a place where normally one would not expect to see any dignitaries except those who are attending the function. Normally the president has a washroom set up for his use only, and that's where they place me, not knowing that an event would happen that would change my life. At 8:30 p.m. on April 28, 1961, a motorcade pulled up in front of McCormick Place. And me standing on the lower level was one flight down from where the motorcade was, entrance to. And I was straining my neck trying to see the President of the United States, because he had impressed me with his sincerity and ambition for the American people. So when I looked up the steps, I was surprised to see the President coming down the steps. The first thing he wanted to do when he arrived at McCormick Place was to use the washroom, and there I stood. The president stopped right in front of me, and he smiled, and he looked at me, and he said, "Are you a Secret Service agent, or are you one of Mayor Daley's professionals?" Said, "I'm a Secret Service agent, Mr. President." One of the agents, Richard Jordan, said his name is Abraham Bowen. He's stationed in Chicago. President and I are in a hand grip, all during the conversation. He wouldn't turn my hand a little. And he looked in my eyes and he smiled. And he said, "Mr. Bowling," and that's what he called me from then on. Whenever he saw me, it was Mr. Bowling. He said, "Mr. Bowling, has there ever been a Negro on the Secret Service detail in Washington, D.C.?" And I said, "Not to my knowledge, Mr. President." And he looked very sincere and he said, "Would you like to be the first?" I said, "Yes, sir, Mr. President." So you can see that there was a cosmic event going on there, here. was the President of the United States inviting me, a secret, Negro Secret Service agent, in front of a washroom of all places, to march into American history, to be a credit to my people, to do some of the things that I had dreamed about doing. And that is to find some avenue in which to help uplift fallen men. And so on June 6, 1961, I reported to Washington, D.C. on a memo from the White House and walked through those two white doors and became the first African-American Secret Service agent assigned to the White House detail. I was awestruck. As a matter of fact, on April the 28th, when I came home and told my wife that I had met the President of the United States, she looked at me and said, "You lying, eh?" I said, "No, I'm telling the truth." I said, "We shook hands." She said, "Oh, come on, eh?" I said, "And he invited me to Washington, D.C. She said, "Oh, that's too much." She didn't want to believe it because it was so coincidental. And it was one of the things, because I had talked with her many, many times about becoming an ambassador or some diplomat to serve the United States government and help uplift my people. Now, when I went into the White House, it was like Peter Rabbit walking into a thorn bush. There was no welcome for me. The agents, many of the agents, not all of the agents that were assigned to the White House detail, either ignored or showed some mannerism that would disregard me as a person. As a matter of fact, during my venture within the Secret Service assigned to the White House detail, I had an occasion to go to Nantucket Sound with the President on the 4th of July. He left, actually left Washington, D.C. on the 2nd of July. And we went to Hyannisport, Massachusetts, where the President, number one, he introduced me to all the young kids who had a pickup football game going on in front of the Kennedy compound. He called them together. And I'm not sure just what children were there, but there was a whole stuff. And he said, "You're going to see Abraham Baldwin walking back and forth around the compound. This is Mr. Baldwin. He is a Secret Service agent. And if you address him, you address him as Mr. Baldwin." No, and that made a deep impression upon me, because my people were being called all over the world any name except Mr. We were lowly regarded, hunted down like rabbits, like deer, murder. And not only were anyone who sympathized with us were given the same treatment. And I just thought it was so remarkable in such an event for me to be moving in the path that I was moving in, becoming a historical individual, a positive historical individual, where there was so much negative publicity concerning my people.
Well, this sets the stage for so much else that we're going to talk about. And let me just give a bit of a preview to our audience that we're going to get into some quite significant historical revelations that have been ignored or at least given short shrift by historians, news accounts, and so forth later in this interview. But just to underscore for a few more moments what you've been talking about in such a powerful way, could you please describe a little bit about how segregation affected even Washington, D.C. quite deeply in the 1960s? It wasn't just the South or South Boston. And I'll just say briefly that Wayne and I are members of the National Press Club, and we recall from history, looking back, that when the Speaker's Committee had the nerve to invite Dr. King to give the first talk at the National Press Club by an African American, the head of the Speaker's Committee quit in protest at such a thing, and this was 1962. But there were many parts of the rest of the city were also, in effect, segregated, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And the thing about it is this, is that the segregated policies were supported by high elected officials, which you don't have that today. I mean, they were openly saying that segregation was dangerous to the existence of the European nation. And we were being lynched in the open. Our houses were being bombed. Churches were being set afire. Four young ladies, four young children were burned alive in a church in Alabama. And so this is the situation. And as I said, this segregated policy that was being followed within the United States at that time.
Were you so, please go ahead.
President Kennedy noticed it. And he sincerely faced American people and said that he would do something to bring about a change. And I believed him, and thousands and millions of my people believed. And that's how he became the president. Now, one thing that deeply disturbed me was I was on the post in June, standing in front of the White House door. The vice president at that time was Lyndon Baines Johnson. I was on post standing right in front of the White House door on about April the 29th.
Pardon me, I've done some research on this. Are you sure it might have been?
No, it was later, June,
perhaps.
Yes, it was June. No question about that. When President Johnson made a visit to the Oval Office, when the door opened, the first thing that President Johnson said to the two who were standing in the Oval Office at that time, who were Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy, said, "Are you bastards trying to send me to prison about some goddamn cotton?" Those were his exact words. And then the door closed. I could hear a terrific argument going on within the Oval Office. And when Johnson came out of the office, he made this statement: "You bastards had better stop fucking with me, you motherfuckers." He made a statement, and his face was red. It was puffed up like a person who sincerely was angry beyond imagination. And so when I saw that, I recognized the fact that the life of President Kennedy was in danger. And so after we left Hyannisport in July of 1961, and I visited the chief's office on the exit interview. I warned the chief of the United States Secret Service, Ulysses E. Bell, that President Kennedy's life was in jeopardy and that something changes had to be made. Within the detail of Secret Service agents surrounding the president, because they were lax, and there was a horrible incident involving the LBJ, that I felt that there was a serious threat on the life of the president of the United States.
Let me interject some historical context that partly comes from your work in later years, along with other researchers, about this incident. But first, you have amplified what you said just now in a fairly lengthy email that I have, and to Robert Morrow. I'm going to send that to you separately to authenticate, but what you've said jives with the memo, and get your confirmation that what you recalled in the memo is correct. But let me also just show our audience that this is a book by that has a chapter on what you've described. There are other books that describe it. Here's one by James Tague. And the gist of it is just as sinister as our guest has described, because there was a mysterious murder of a man named Henry Marshall, who was a kind of mid-level investigator for the Department of Agriculture. And he was investigating an aide to a corrupt business associate of Lyndon Johnson and Billy Saul Esses, who would go on to go to prison. And the context was that Esses' corruption was directly linked to Vice President Johnson. And so suddenly Henry Marshall, the investigator for the Agriculture Department, is found mysteriously dead a few months before this confrontation. And people in the federal government want to know what happened to this investigator. And so that's remained a mystery for many years. And the essence of the books that I've shown on screen is that the death was immediately ruled a suicide, despite indications that it was obviously a murder. And only decades later was the family able to have it listed officially as a homicide. And incidentally, this person, Billy Saul Esses, I won't go on and on, I'm not the guest or our witnesses, but in this book, Being There, the author, Douglas Caddy, who represented as an attorney Billy Saul Esses, writes in his memoir, Being There, that he helped Billy Saul Esses submit an affidavit to the U.S. Justice Department in approximately 1984, arguing that Lyndon Johnson, the vice president and previously the Senate majority leader, had been involved with more than a dozen murders, including of this Henry Marshall and other people, including his sister and her boyfriend. So when our guest is talking about his sense that this is an angry vice president with anger directed toward the Kennedys, this is obviously our guest's impression. But there could have been some substance that led a trained investigator to suspect that. Now, just to underscore this and get back to questions, you have talked about this, but you probably haven't talked that much about the conversation you overheard while on guard duty at the White House and the insult that the vice president directed at you because of your race and his anger. Why is it that you haven't talked about it much before now? And why are you talking about it now?
Because I did not have the proof. I did not have enough proof that I had overheard the conversation that took place. As a matter of fact, it would have until recently been very difficult, meaning to prove that I was even standing by the door or even that a conversation like that took place. But now much of what I have said has been confirmed by other sources. Now I can speak on it with some type of credibility. When I brought this before Chief U.E. Bowden and Inspector Tom Keller, none of them wanted to believe that I had overheard what I overheard. None of them wanted to consider my opinion that there was a serious rift between President Johnson and Kennedy that could lead to the assassination of a president of the United States.
Well,
they didn't want to believe that.
Well, you speak very convincingly of it, and I have had a chance to see many confirming sources. Before letting my co-hosts get into this, I do have two more kind of specific questions that I'd like to pose to you about the Secret Service. You mentioned the chief that you talked about, that you reported to and who you went to in July. Now, there's an author we both know named Vince Palomara, who's done exceptional work on the Secret Service, particularly interviewing scores, probably 150 former agents from that period in the 1960s, and including you. And one of the points he makes is that the head of the Secret Service, and I believe it was James Rowley, was very close to Lyndon Johnson. And in fact, I believe the argument is that Johnson helped obtain the appointment of the head of the Secret Service, just as Johnson had kind of placed his loyalists throughout the federal government in key spots. Can you talk briefly about that, or at least to confirm that that's your understanding, to help modern people understand why?
I cannot confirm that Johnson had anything to do with James Rowley becoming the chief of the United States Secret Service, because Rowley was already in charge of the White House detail. He was chief of the White House detail division of the Secret Service. Now, when I discussed this matter with Chief U.E. Bowman, I had no idea that he was about to retire. Now, when he retired, President Kennedy was still alive. So President Kennedy is the person responsible for when James Rowley is chief of the Secret Service. I'm not saying he appointed him, you know, specifically. What I am saying that it was under Kennedy's administration. U.E. Bowman retired shortly after our discussion, as a matter of fact. And after U.E. Bowman retired and James Rowley was appointed as chief of the entire Secret Service, he had authority and he had the permission to view many of the conversations that I had had with Chief U.E. Bowman. And in many of those conversations, during which time I was there, on July the 5th, during our discussion, I lambasted James Riley for being negligent as chief of the Secret Service Deep White House. And so when I heard that James Riley was now chief of the United States Secret Service, I applied for several other jobs in security because I knew that they were going to come after me. I knew it. I didn't know when, but I knew that they would come after me, not because of an assassination, but because I had opened up about conversations that I heard with President Johnson, and that I had told a former chief of the Secret Service about the undoing of duty of James Robb, who now has a building named after him in Washington, D.C. So you could see that my days were numbered, because when James Riley came into power and sat in that chair of the chief's office, everything that I had told U.E. Bauman about James Riley became known to Riley. Days were numbered.
We'll get into the awful retribution shortly, but I'll just make two other quick points. This series of recommendations and animosities is something that certainly Wayne has observed in his years in Washington. In fact, Wayne used to, let me summarize this, I hope accurately, but Wayne used to spend a lot of time in a bar where a lot of Secret Service agents would go after work after their presidential details. And
it's no longer there, the bar. It's
no longer there, but Wayne's memories of the conversations is still with him. Here's my additional question. Often, and you're in a position to know about this, particularly since at some point here, we're going to talk about two other potential assassination attempts beyond Dallas on JFK in Chicago and Tampa, both of which were rumored to also involve shootings, attempted shootings with rifles from high levels. The average person says, well, it must be only in modern times that Secret Service and police would protect a parade route, whereas some historians say that going all the way back to Roosevelt in the 1930s, Secret Service would protect parade routes, and that it would be an aberration for the Secret Service not to protect a building like in Dallas from having a shooter. What's your experience on what standard operating procedure was in the early 60s when a president would travel?
Well, the standard operating procedure was to send an advance agent, and he was supposed to take care of the security with a number of the sheriff's department in the county and the local police. And the Secret Service agents assigned to that particular district would also be assigned certain positions in regard to the protection of the president. Now, I think that Lawson, who was the advanced person who did the advanced detail for President Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, was one of the most diligent Secret Service agents during that period of time. That is why it never reached Lawson that the threat had been made that the President of the United States was going to be killed from a warehouse building, a long-range gun with a telescopic sight. Now, this was described in a conversation that took place in 1963 in Miami, Florida, between a Secret Service informant and a conspirator. He described how the president would be assassinated. During that same time, the president, in November of 1963, was supposed to come to Chicago to attend the Army Air Force football game. A call came into the Secret Service office saying that they had information from a person who called himself Lee. The FBI called the Secret Service during a meeting that we were preparing for November 2nd when the president was to come to Chicago. Lee informed the FBI. The FBI called Mr. Maurice G. Martineau of the Secret Service and said, we have information that there will be an assassination attempt on the president if he comes to Chicago to the football game. Now, I'm not a researcher. I had not delved into any of this that the research was finding out today. But I do know that in October of 1963, there was another information that was gathered by the Secret Service informant in Chicago that said that the president was about to be assassinated and that it was a done deal, that the money had been put up by Israeli sources. Now, the Secret Service had this information. In Chicago, we had a person under surveillance in November. His name was Vali. Vali had been known, had been said, to have been making threats about the life of the president. On about November the 1st, Vali was picked up by members of the Secret Service in Chicago, and they found rifles in the back of his trunk, along with some explosives. But he was never charged with anything, and all of a sudden he disappeared. Now, you know, on November 1st, Diem of South Vietnam was assassinated. President Kennedy was to come to Chicago on November 2nd. But early in October, there were a company of Cubans, there were four Cubans that came and rented a house, a hotel room on the north side of Chicago. The landlady who cleaned the room looked inside and said that she saw rifles with telescopic sight laying on the bed. So she was suspicious that these persons were up to some wrongdoing. She didn't associate it at the time with the assassination of the president, but with the threats that the Secret Service knew about, I immediately associated the two. Now, I couldn't prove that there were anyone that came from anywhere else in order to harm the president. I couldn't even prove that there were anybody came from Detroit, but other researchers, long after the event, found out that there was in fact gun runners who came from Detroit to the north side of Chicago for the purpose of selling arms. And that's what the landlady had seen.
Well, just to be clear, you worked as an investigator on the ground on this case. You saw some evidence, but you're not in a position to pull it all together. But you know also that the normal news media didn't really cover it, although some were aware of it. And now, maybe because I'm talking too much, let me hand things off to my co-host, Wayne Madsen, because Wayne has actually, in his diverse career, had conversations about this kind of things with people like former Governor John Connally, Pierre Salinger, the press secretary to JFK. And without getting too much into the specifics, Wayne, you've heard the investigator talk about what it's like to see the evidence and not see news coverage, but you also know from the high levels, and of course to our younger audience, John Connally was shot in the limo with President Kennedy. And here's maybe a question to Wayne, but I'll let you take things where you think best. Why can't people at the top talk about this stuff? We know why an ordinary agent or newspaper reporter might not be able to, but Wayne, why don't people at the top talk about this stuff?
Well, I think, you know, with Governor Connally, of course, I wasn't even involved in journalism. I happened to have met him at a conference in Houston after he had declared bankruptcy. And it was a well-heeled conference, to say the least. President Ford was there. I was actually providing security for the conference. And they asked me to watch the buffet table. First guy that came in the room was Governor Connally. And so I had him, maybe he, you know, he wanted to make sure he got there first so he could get something to eat because he had declared personal bankruptcy. But I had him for 15 minutes, just him and I in the room. And I got around to, and I was a little hesitant to bring it up, but I said, Governor, while you're here and we're talking, I remember you said something in the limousine after the shots rang out. You said something like, my God, they're going to kill all of us. I said, why did you say they? And he looked at me, and you know, I was in my 30s. He says, young man, I was in the Navy in World War II, and I know when I'm caught in a crossfire. And I thought that was pretty interesting because, you know, Mrs. Kennedy said, she yelled out, they killed Jack. I think some people obviously did know, but they never spoke. Connally, of course, was a good buddy of LBJ. I was going to ask you too, the trip to Chicago by President Kennedy, he was supposed to go to that Army Air Force game. What happened to his schedule? I understand at the last minute. Was it changed?
It was canceled, yes. They canceled it out. But in order to prepare for it, they did have every overpass coming from O'Hare Airport all the way into Chicago, some 9 or 10 miles. They put a police car, a patrol car, on every over or underpass leading to Chicago to the Conrad Hilton Hotel.
Would they have done that?
Yeah.
Would they have done that without the warning, or was it?
No, they wouldn't have done that without the warning. Because you have to understand that, number one, the president was traveling then in a steel top car. When he came here, he was in a steel top car when he came back here in 1963. Now, the warning that we had received, some of the agents did not take it serious. But me, when I was matching up with the fact that Diem had been assassinated, and Diem and Kennedy was trying to work something out about Vietnam. You see, my mind was traveling so fast, I was connecting things that I shouldn't have been able to connect. I could see things, I could see this thing building up to the death of President Kennedy. I could just feel it, I could taste. And nobody wanted to take action. Now, those buildings in Dallas, Texas, there was no reason according to protocol for anyone to have been able to sit near an open window. When Lawson knew that, when he did the advanced survey, his advanced survey lied and said that all of these methods that were prescribed by the PRS, Protective Research Division, had been followed. So that means that someone after the protective research was done, interrupted and changed the method of the president's route and the precautions taken to make sure that he wasn't assassinated.
Well, that's so ominous and so valid. We're getting at the 50-minute mark here, and there's so much more to say that what I'm going to do is, at the risk of cutting just a little bit into your time, but ultimately to allow you to talk about new things, is to sum up what you describe in such a powerful way in your book, how you were framed in a way that anyone with an ounce of fairness can see was a total abuse of the system, totally unjustified charges. Let me summarize it, and maybe you can amplify a little bit, but we'd like to use more of your time for big picture stuff because you've written it so well here. Basically, a counterfeiter that you had prosecuted suddenly pops up after his conviction and says you had sought a bribe from him, and you are almost immediately indicted, arrested, put to trial, hung jury, brought to a second trial, and with a judge who was totally unfair, convicted. Your appeals transcripts were lost. You were sent to prison. They tried to give you drugs that you had to pretend to take to shut you up, and anyone can see that that was a total frame-up. Particularly, I mean, there's 100 different reasons, but one is immediately after the conviction, the counterfeiter said he perjured himself because the prosecutors threatened him if he didn't lie about your complicity, and the judge said, well, that doesn't matter. Now, have I missed anything on that short summary? And are there things to add? I'm sure there are, but I'd like to take at least some of our time for your larger thoughts. But did I boil that down correctly, or did I miss
something? Yes, it was perfect. I had gone to Washington, D.C. on May the 17th. 1964. While I was there, I was told that I had to return to Chicago because a counterfeiting ring had been broken in one of the suburbs of Chicago. And they needed my expertise in infiltrating the rest of the group. When I came back to Chicago, I was taken to the United States Attorney's Office, where Mr. Martinoff, the U.S. Attorney, said, we're going to charge you with trying to sell a file, soliciting a bribe. Now, sure, I had a trial. As a matter of fact, you can go into federal history trials, and no defendant has had to endure two trials back to back without a continuance. Had a trial start July the 6th, another one started August the 3rd. That's unheard of. You have Trump now, he was recently indicted. He won't be tried for several months. There were others who were indicted in Chicago. They were released for several months. I was arrested, tried within 30 days, had two trials within 3 months. Unheard of in federal judicial proceedings.
Oh, there's so many things about it. I got enraged just rereading even a small part of it last night in your book. For example, how they systematically kicked all of Black jurors off the case. By the way, I've looked up who was this judge. Well, he's both from Northern Alabama, born in 1896, the height of Jim Crow, but he also went to the University of Chicago Law School. And Wayne has pointed out that the prosecutor was a notorious political prosecutor, Ed Hanrahan. Afterwards, you serve your time. You lived a very impressive life. Accumulating supporters who recognize your bravery. You testified to the House Investigating Committee on this. You had originally tried to go to the Warren Commission, and yeah. It's part of what happened that this whole kangaroo court help prevent you from talking to authorities at the time.
Yes.
Well, this is done with. And as we get to the end of our time, and I don't think we have to end exactly on the moment, but the Secret Service is back in the news. Issues of race and civil rights are in the news. Let me mention quickly in passing that my co-host, Wayne Madsen, who's now spending a lot of time in Florida, has planned a book for children. And Wayne, why don't you talk just briefly and maybe frame a question for our guests about what your book is?
Well, it's called a Woke History Coloring Book. After putting up with Ron DeSantis down here and what he's doing to history courses and library shelves, I realize there's a lot of stories that kids should know, but DeSantis is making it almost impossible for these history lessons to be taught. So it's a children's coloring book. It's limited in pages, but I'm looking at people who have these compelling stories that kids need to know. And not at all kids. It doesn't matter their race, their religion, where they, their national origin. They should know it. And I've included you in this. I'm leaving it up to the kids. I have outlines of the photographs, but they're without any color. So I'm leaving it to the kids to color in these figures, because people like DeSantis are taking the color out of our history. And I've included you along with Jackie Robinson and so many other figures in the civil rights movement, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, African Americans, and people like Reverend Reeb, who was beaten to death after arriving in Selma after the Bloody Sunday. He was a white minister from the North. And these stories, of course, need to be told. And I just wanted you to know that your story is so important and compelling. I've decided it has to be in this Woke History Coloring Book.
I appreciate that very much, sir. But I want everybody to know that can hear the sound of my voice. America is headed for some of the worst strife that the world has ever seen. Everything that is being accomplished today by a certain group of people is being done to ensure that the European nations rule the whole world. That's what this is all about. And I just want your audience to know, and everyone to know, that the Black man, a Negro, or African American is not going back into slavery. We're not going to be slaves to the European anymore. That's over with. We're going to fight. We're going to fight. And as the Bible says, the blood is going to be up to a horse's hoof. But my people never again shall be slaves to another nation. God told me that, and I believe God.
That's a very powerful message.
I'm going to say, on after what happened yesterday in Nashville, your words even have greater meaning. They were some very eloquent speeches given from the floor of the House of Representatives. And I thought I was listening to Reverend King, Malcolm X, all over again. Those speeches and what you just said are reminiscent of those voices from the 1960s.
Well, let me add that Wayne is the author of 22 books and also a daily investigative site, the Wayne Madsen Report, and it draws heavily on his world experiences, including working for Navy intelligence. And one of the things that as a historian, Wayne has identified important ties to between the fascist Nazi movement in the 1930s and the current white nationalists that dominate the Republican Party. In fact, he's written an entire book about it called, Wayne, what's the title of your book?
It's the fascist Fourth Reich, the rise of Donald Trump and fascism.
So this is a frequent theme. But let me also talk about the, maybe as a final point, your reaction to what some might think was a surprising, although merited, but a surprising gesture by President Biden to make you one of the first three pardons of his administration last year. He's sometimes thought of as very careful and not willing to rock the boat, but giving you a pardon was, given what you stand for and what your life exemplifies and the history, this is not like giving a pardon to a grandmother who was indicted because her grandson had drugs in the chest of drawers. You're a brave historical figure and focusing on your pardon surely must have been a statement that the JFK assassination and the people who killed him are worth reevaluating. Correct? Or what's your thought on
the significance
of his pardon?
My thought to this is that right after Trump was elected, Trump had been in office 1961 for about 3 or 4 months. My pardon application had been filed under President Obama, who took no action whatsoever. When President Trump was elected in April or May after his election. He sent two FBI agents to my house after someone had brought to his attention that I had a pardon pen. And they interviewed me for 6 hours. They talked to everybody almost in the neighborhood, St. Louis, everywhere that I had lived. They did a re-background check on me to see if I could qualify. Now, things developed where President Trump could not sign that part. In the meantime, because of problems of his own, President Trump began to pardon so many people that a pardon from President Trump went to Mendocino paper to me, even though he renewed the interest in it. Now, by President Obama ignoring the fact of the discrimination, the segregation, and the embarrassment that I had received as an agent of the government. And by me bringing that fact forth to the American people through Facebook and other writings that I did, I put the pressure on Biden to take action. I put the pressure on him through President Obama. I went to the newspapers here in Chicago. Mayor Mitchell of the Sun-Times took up my fight and was belaying how awful it was that President Obama hadn't taken any action, had not even answered one letter concerning the party. To put the pressure on Obama because they had an election coming up and they wanted it stopped after Biden pardoned me because of the pressure that people like Mayor Mitchell of the Sun-Times put on my case and the injustice. Biden gave me a pardon. And we asked for a pardon because of innocence. That's the only way that I would accept a pardon. It had to be because of innocence. That is written in the pardon. And by him granting that pardon, as it was filed, then he is declaring as the president of the United States that I was innocent at the time I was convicted. And I deeply appreciate him signing that pardon application. Now, it'll do me a little good. Now, I'm 88 years old, half blind, crippled, going crazy. So it'll do me a little good now. But I am able to carry on and be of service to humanity. And that was my original goal in life.
Well, you've certainly lived up to it. And here's what I think we'll do is we want to get this interview wider dissemination. So we better stop at an appropriate time. And I think that would be now. And get new audiences, but we want to have you back on District Insiders some other time because you've got so much to share with the world, and we're just truly blessed that you spent this time with us now. So thank you. And one other thing that we're going to do is we're going to have an array of research materials and background, and of course links to your book. We've already got an array of photos that are going to help keep your story going, both for the purposes of this broadcast, but in wider concentric circles through the years. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, well, thank you. I just want you to know And one of the reasons I'm giving this interview today is that Mr. Andrew Craig, when nobody believed in me, when nobody supported me, he stood with me through all the trials and tribulations I was going through in life. And I deeply appreciate it. And may God bless you, and may God bless America. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. So long.